And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, thank you very much for coming along to our program this evening. Tonight we're looking just as an introduction to this book of Daniel. Firstly, we'll look at prophecy and prophets in general, and then we'll hone in on the who and when of this man Daniel, and we'll conclude with a glimpse at the book of Daniel. On the very last day, the very last day of Jesus' public ministry, he was giving his disciples this panoramic view of prophecy encompassing what we now know as the next 20 centuries, from the time that he was here right through till his second coming in glory. His disciples asked him for a specific sign of the end of the world, and he replied, in effect, that would be deceptive religious leaders appearing, wars, famines, pestilences, earthquakes, and persecutions to herald in the end. But the special sign that they were to watch for was the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place where it ought not, as foretold by Daniel the prophet. And we read this in Matthew 24 and verse 15, and also in Mark 13 and verse 14. To underline his warning based on Daniel the prophet, Christ solemnly added this admonition: "Whoso readeth, let him understand." The only Old Testament book to which Christ specifically pointed, saying, "Understand it," is this book of Daniel. And this cryptic emphasis was given especially for those of us living in these end times, when the signs declare that the world as we know it is coming to an end, staggering on its feet. At a time, as Luke 1, 25 and 26 says, at a time when upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, men's hearts failing them for fear, then those who understand this prophetic word of hope and promise are going to look up, knowing that deliverance from mortality, sorrow and evil is imminent. This confidence will be possible because believers will recognize in the apparent tragic events of their time the fulfillment of the predictions of this man Daniel, a recognition made possible by obedience to the command of Christ to understand the writings of this Old Testament prophet. Now, whereabouts does Daniel fall in the scheme of things with regard to the Bible? Now, if we look at the Old Testament, we will find it neatly divides itself into three divisions. In the same way that the New Testament starts with the Gospels, and then we have a section of the Epistles, those special letters to the churches, and then the revelation of John the Divine as three distinct divisions or sections, so we find the Old Testament is divided likewise. The historical books begin the Old Testament. These are the books from Genesis through to Esther, and they're the story of the rise and the fall of the Hebrew nation. The poetical books, that is from Job through to Song of Songs, or Song of Solomon as it's sometimes called, they generally belong to what we might call the golden age of the Hebrew nation. That is the books of poetry. And the third division, or classification if you like, is the prophetical books. You know, the word Bible simply means a collection or a library of books. And in our public library we find that the books are gathered together under general subjects. And that's what it's like in our Old Testament. And the third subject is the prophetical books, those dealing with prophecy. These are the books from Isaiah through to Malachi at the end of the Old Testament. And they belong to the days of the fall of the Hebrew nation. Now, there are 17 books of prophets, or prophetics, but there are only 16 prophets who wrote them. Now, of course, there were many prophets who didn't write books. For example, Elisha was a prophet, and yet we don't have any of his written writings. In the New Testament times, for example, we have John the Baptist, whom Jesus declared to be one of the greatest of the prophets, and yet we have no recorded writings of John the Baptist. Likewise, in the Old Testament, there are many prophets of whom we have no recorded writings, but of the 16 prophets who wrote, we have 16 books, plus the book Lamentations, which was written also by the prophet Jeremiah. These books are ordinarily spoken of as major prophets and minor prophets. The major prophets are those big four: Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and, as we're coming to very soon, Daniel. The minor prophets, that is Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, have the smaller books. Now, this classification is not in importance. This is talking about the size of the books that they have written. Any one of the three books, Isaiah, Jeremiah, or Ezekiel, of the major prophets, is in itself alone larger than all 12 of the minor prophets combined together. And the book of Daniel is about the size of the two largest of the minor prophets, Hosea and Zechariah. We can also classify these books in terms of time. 13 of the prophets were connected with the destruction of the Hebrew nation, and 3 with its restoration. The destruction was accomplished in 2 periods. The northern kingdom fell, 734 to 721 BC, preceding and during this period were Joel, Jonah, Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, and Micah. The southern kingdom fell from 606 to 586 BC, and in this period were Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Obadiah, Nahum, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah. The restoration of the nation, which occurred 536 to 440 BC, connected to this period were Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Of course, we can also classify these books of prophetics, these prophecy books, in terms of their message. You see, some were directed specifically to Israel. We could mention Amos and Hosea. Some specifically to Nineveh. Jonah springs to mind first of all. And Nahum was specifically to Nineveh. Daniel to Babylon, and Ezekiel to the captives in Babylon. Obadiah has a very damning message to Edom. And the other prophets, Joel, Isaiah, Micah, Jeremiah, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, were to Judah. Now, the historical event that called forth the work of the prophets was the apostasy of the 10 tribes of Israel at the close of Solomon's reign, which you read about in 1 Kings chapter 12. This was a political measure to keep the two kingdoms separate, the northern kingdom adopting as their national religion calf worship. That was the religion of Egypt. And very soon afterward they added Baal worship, which also got a hold on the southern kingdom. It was at this crisis, when God's name was disappearing from the minds of men and God's plan for the ultimate redemption of the world, it appeared, was coming to naught. It was then that the prophets appeared. But what about the priests? Surely there were priests at this time. What were they doing? Well, there's a bit of a distinction which I'd like to make right now between the priestly class and the prophets. You see, the priests were the regularly appointed religious leaders of the time. They were an hereditary class, and often they were the wickedest men in the nation. Still, they were the religious teachers. But instead of crying out against the sins of the people, well, let me tell you a story. There was a preacher who was standing in the pulpit, yelling hellfire and damnation, and condemning the congregation for all their sins, and he took the time to list them in detail, one at a time, the things that he had observed or imagined he had perceived in his congregation. And he listed out these sins in rather explicit detail, and after the service a young girl came up to him and said, "You sure know a lot about sin." Well, that's what it was like with these priests, because instead of crying out against the sins, they fell in with them and became leaders in iniquity. Prophets, however, were not an hereditary class. Each one got his call directly from God. In fact, they all had different vocations prior to this time. Many of them, we don't know what their occupation was, but we know that they were called from their occupation to be prophets. Jonah, for example, we only have just a few short months of Jonah's life recorded in his role as a prophet. And yet what a message it was. We know, for example, that Jeremiah and Ezekiel were priests. And it's possible, too, that Zechariah was a priest. We know also that Isaiah, Daniel, and Zephaniah were of royal blood. With the exception of Amos, whom we know was a shepherd, we're not really sure of the occupations of the others. But certainly, it was in a different class to the regular priest. Now, each of these prophets had a specific message. Their message was to try and save the nation from its idolatry and its wickedness. And failing in this, they were to announce that the nation would be destroyed, but not completely. A remnant would be saved. And out of this remnant will come a person who will bring all nations to God. Most of the prophets describe this person as a great man, or person who will one day arise in the family of David. They call him various names: the branch, the son of man, the family tree of David, which was once the most powerful family in the world, was cut down in the days of the prophets to rule a kingdom that was fast disappearing. And the prophets tell us that there will be a comeback. Out of that family stock will be a branch who will become the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now, if you have a look on the overhead now, you will find a chart listing the period of the prophets. In fact, the first overhead you see is an outline of the Bible right from Genesis through to Revelation. And in this little segment here, we have the period of the prophets, roughly covering about 400 years from 800 BC down to 400 BC. The central event, as you can see by the chart here, was the destruction of Jerusalem around about the middle of that period chronologically. And actually with this event, one way or another, either chronologically or directly, seven of the prophets were connected. We have Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Obadiah, Nahum, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah. The fall of Jerusalem was the time of the greatest prophetic activity in Old Testament times, either trying to prevent it, or, as we will see later, trying to explain it. Even though it was God who brought upon this destruction, humanly speaking, he did all that was possible to try and save that institution. Faultless though it was, faulty though it was, he tried to prevent it from crumbling apart? Well, failing, it seems, to save this unholy, holy city, the prophets literally glow with divine explanations and assurances that the collapse of God's nation doesn't mean the end of God's plan. That after a period of punishment, there would be a restoration. And for God's people, a glorious future. Now, each of these prophets had also a social message, because you see, the great emphasis was on their denunciation of political corruption, oppression, and the moral rottenness of the nation. However, the thing that is most often overlooked by modern-day writers was of great concern to these prophets, and that is the idolatry. And as you will find from our studies later on, as we delve deeper into the book of Daniel, there is another element which is often overlooked and neglected. And I personally find this one of the most challenging and exciting parts of prophecy, because when you lay it out alongside secular writings, it can reassure you beyond a shadow of a doubt that God had his plan and his hand in the writing of these books. And that is the predictive element in prophecy. The most persistent thought in the entire Old Testament is this: God, the God of the Hebrew nation, is going to become the God of all nations. The prophets, though they may not have understood the full import of some of their words, and though some of them were rather blurred in the cloudy history and historical events of their own day, the simple story of Jesus and the spread of Christianity over the earth has been pictured beforehand, both in outline in great panorama and also in minutiae, in fine detail, in language that cannot refer to anything else in history, I believe. There is this predictive element. Now, Haley's Bible Dictionary gives us a very useful tool when it comes to studying prophecy and understanding the panorama view of the individual prophets. We have another overhead here which I have taken directly out of Haley's Bible Dictionary. It's a message from each of the prophets expressed in one line. We have Joel, who has a vision of the golden age and the ingathering of the nations. Jonah shows us not just the story of Nineveh, but he reveals to us and to the Jewish nation that God's interest wasn't just in Israel, but also in Israel's enemies. Amos's focus was on David's house, which was yet to rule the world. Hosea reminds us that Jehovah God will one day be the God of all nations. Isaiah tells us that God has a remnant, and for that remnant, a glorious future. Micah talks about the coming prince of, wait for it, of Bethlehem, and for his universal reign. Nahum, the impending judgment upon Nineveh. Zephaniah, the coming of a new revelation called by a new name. Jeremiah and Ezekiel talk of Jerusalem's sin, doom, and their future, and Ezekiel emphasizes the restoration of Jerusalem. Obadiah, as I mentioned before, tells us that Edom will utterly perish. Daniel, as we'll find out soon when we look at the book of Daniel, talks about four kingdoms and a very special kingdom, God's everlasting kingdom. Habakkuk talks about the ultimate triumph for Jehovah's people. Haggai talks about the second temple and the coming of a greater temple. Zechariah tells us about the coming king, his house and his kingdom. And finally, Malachi gives us the closing message to the messianic nation, a message of warning to carry us over that intertestament period. Now, before we move specifically onto the book of Daniel, do we have any questions? Well, now we'll spend our time looking specifically at Daniel. And we'll start off looking, if you like to look at the slides on the screen, the city of Babylon, the scene of Daniel's ministry. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was situated in the cradle of the human race near the Garden of Eden region, and it was built around the Tower of Babel, we assume. There was a great tower there, we call it the Tower of Babylon, but it's possible that this was the seat of the first empire. We know that it was a favourite residence of Babylonian, Assyrian and Persian kings. In fact, even Alexander the Great had this as a commanding city through the whole pre-Christian era. And it was brought to the zenith, the peak of its power and glory, in the days of Daniel, by Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel's friend, and it was during Nebuchadnezzar's 45-year reign that he never wearied of building and rebuilding, beautifying palaces, temples, gardens. The size of Babylon, these ancient historians tell us, was the its wall was 60 miles around, 15 miles on each side, 300 feet high, 80 feet thick, and extended 35 feet below the ground so that its enemies could not tunnel under. It was built of brick, 1 foot square, 1 foot square and 3 to 4 inches thick, and there was a quarter of a mile of clear space between the city and the wall all the way around. The wall was protected by wide and deep moats or canals filled with water. And as you see from this slide, here's one of these 250 towers that they had on the wall with guard rooms for each of the soldiers. 100 gates of brass were along this wall. And as you see from this aerial view, the city was divided by the Euphrates into two almost equal parts, both banks guarded by brick walls all along the way, with 25 gates connecting the streets and ferry boats. There was a bridge across that was on stone piers. It was half a mile long and 30 feet wide, with drawbridges that were removed at night time. There was a tunnel under the river, 15 foot wide and 12 feet high. And it's interesting that excavations of recent years to a large extent have verified these fabulous accounts of the ancient historians. This great temple of Marduk we have in artist's impression here, adjoining the Tower of Babylon, or maybe the Tower of Babel, it was the most renowned sanctuary in all the Euphrates Valley. Contained the golden image of Bel and a golden table which together weighed not less than 50,000 pounds. At the top were golden images of Bel and Ashtar, two golden lions, This table was, I mentioned, was 40 feet long and 15 foot wide. And there was a human figure of solid gold, 18 foot high. You know, Isaiah 14 verse 4 tells us that Babylon was a city of gold. And it was a religious city too. It had 53 temples and 180 altars to Ishtar. You know, it might have been in this plain that we can see in this drawing, between the Tower of Babylon and the Palace of Nebuchadnezzar, that we have the image of gold that we read about in the first verse of chapter 3 of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar's palace, into which Daniel often went, was one of the most magnificent buildings ever erected on earth. Its vast ruins were uncovered by Calderway in 1912. The south walls of the throne room were 20 feet thick, and the northern side of the palace was protected by three walls, and just north of them were more walls, each 50 feet thick. A little further on, still more massive walls, and about a mile further out was the inner wall of the city, which consisted of two parallel walls of brick, each about 20 foot thick, 40 feet apart, and the space between them filled with rubble, making a total thickness of 80 feet, with a deep and wide moat or canal on the outside. Further on was the outer wall, built in the same manner. In fact, in the days of ancient warfare, the city was virtually impregnable. Well, when we come to study chapter 5 of Daniel, we'll find that there was a way through or around or under it, as you're going to find out when Belshazzar comes on the scene. You know, I said this was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Well, that wasn't exactly the city of Babylon, but it was something in it. It was the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, built by Nebuchadnezzar for his Median queen, beautiful daughter of Cyaxares, who helped his father conquer Nineveh. This hanging garden, it wasn't called hanging because it was suspended. The plants were hanging down over these several tiers of arches, one on top of each other, each bearing a solid gold platform. It was 400 feet square, with terraces and the top covered with flowers and shrubs and trees, even a garden on the roof. It was watered from a reservoir at the top, to which water was raised from the river by hydraulic pumps. Underneath the arches, if I can use that expression, there were luxurious apartments. This was the pleasure ground of the palace. Actually, it was built while Daniel was chief governor of the wise men of Babylon, and Calderway uncovered the arches in the northeastern corner of the palace, and he assumes that these arches were the original hanging gardens. Processional Street, the great royal and sacred road entering at the north, gradually ascended past into the palace grounds at the northeast corner, through the Ishtar Gate and high over the centre of the city, gradually descending into the southeast corner of the Tower of Babylon wall, where it turned directly west to the river bridge. On both sides were highly defensive walls, 20 foot thick, adorned with brilliant many-coloured glazed reliefs of lions. We've got an artist's impression of it on the screen just coming up now. Look at this street here. It was paved with stone slabs 3 foot square. In fact, near the entrance to the palace, the blocks are still in their place, just as they were when Daniel walked over them. Well, this city of Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldean pride, according to prophecy, was to become holy desert, desolate, a wilderness, a dry land. We are told in Isaiah 13, verses 17 to 20, and again in Jeremiah 51, verses 37 to 43, that it shall be no more inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. The wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, their houses shall be of doleful creatures. Wolves shall cry in their castles, and jackals in their pleasure palaces. And Babylon shall be desolate forever. They shall sleep a perpetual sleep, and shall not wake. Of course, it remained an important city through the Persian period, and Alexander the Great would have restored its glory, but his plans were cut short by his death. After him, it declined. And by the time of Christ, its political and commercial supremacy had gone, and in the first century AD, the greater part of it was in ruins. Its bricks have been used in building Baghdad and in repairing canals. For centuries, it has been a desolate heap of mounds, a palace for the beasts of the desert, a remarkable fulfillment of its prophecy. In fact, there's a few huts in the little southwestern corner, and apart from that, it is entirely uninhabited. In fact, even the tour guides taking you on the dried up riverbed where the Euphrates used to go are terrified to stay there too long because of the wild beasts that howl in that area. The ruins, and we've got another slide now, present day mounds are all that's left of these great buildings which occupied the central part of the city, mostly on the east side of the river. They cover an area of about 3.5 by 3 miles. Let's have a look on the map on the overhead now. Three principal mounds. Babel, that's the northern mound. Kasr, K-A-S-R, that's the central mound. And Amran, the southern mound. Babel was the fortress guarding the northern entrance of the city, about 1.5 miles between it and Kasr, 130 feet square, 70 feet high. It covers the ruins of the palace of Nebuchadnezzar. Amran, which is 0.5 mile south of Kasr, and about the same size and height, covers, we think, the ruins of the great temple of Marduk. Esagalar, he's called in the contemporary writings. Over here on the plain of the northern edge of the Amran Mound are the ruins of the Great Tower of Babylon. It's been identified as the Tower of Babel. Not quite sure about that. These low mounds here between Kasr and Amran and somewhat eastward are called Merks. That was the business and the residence area of the city. In looking at these ruins on the overhead now, you know, it's pretty hard to realise that here once stood Great Babylon, the city of extravagance and wicked luxury, beyond imagination, unsurpassed in the history of the world. It's now a scene of utter desolation and ruin. Excavations of this city began in 1811, and they were continued by Layard. They were begun by Rich, continued by Layard, 1850, Opert in 1854, Rassam, 1878 to 89, but the most thorough and complete work has been done by a German expedition under Robert Calderway, 1899 to 1912, just over 100 years after Rich began his excavations. Of course, in Daniel's day, the city of Babylon was not only the premier city of the pre-Christian world, but it ruled the most powerful empire that it had up until that time existed. We have on the screen now another artist's impression of this great city of Babylon, and showing this chap Nebuchadnezzar. It wasn't just Nebuchadnezzar that Daniel was under as a king. There are other kings, there were in fact five of them, from the first year of Nebuchadnezzar through the reigns of the succeeding five kings, past the fall of Babylon into the Persian Empire, through the reign of Darius the Mede, right through to the third year of Cyrus the Persian. That's chapter 10, verse 1 of Daniel. In all, from 606 BC to 534 BC. 72 years. From the first year of the Jews' captivity until 2 years after their return from the captivity. Just think, 72 years, God had this witness in the palace of the empire that ruled the world. Daniel lived under the kings of Nabopolassar, 625 to 604 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, 606 to 561 BC, I should say, Evil-Merodach, yes, that was his name, 561 to 560 BC, Nergal-Sarnessar, 559 to 556 BC, Nabush-Marduk, who reigned in 556, and Nabonidus, 555 to 536, and as we will find later, his son Belshazzar. Yes, I'll answer your question in regard to Belshazzar when I come to talk about Daniel chapter 5 in just a few moments. Okay, good. Yes, I can talk about Nebuchadnezzar. Yes. Well, Daniel was a friend and advisor to Nebuchadnezzar. He was the genius and the real builder of the Babylonian Empire. In fact, of the 70 years that the Babylonian Empire existed, Nebuchadnezzar ruled for 45 of them. 45 out of 70. Nabopolassar, that was Nebuchadnezzar's father, he was the viceroy of Babylon, he threw off the Assyrian yoke in 625 BC, and he ruled the city from 625 to 604 BC. In 609 BC, Nebuchadnezzar was placed at the head of his father's armies. Invading the western countries, he wrestled control of Palestine from Egypt, 606 BC, and took some Jewish captives to Babylon. And among these captives was Daniel. That same year, that's 606 BC, he became co-regent with his father and the sole ruler. 604 BC, he proved to be one of the mightiest monarchs of all time. The following year, 605 BC, he broke the power of Egypt in the Battle of Carchemish. In 597, he crushed a new rebellion in Palestine and took King Jehoiakim and many captives to Babylon, and among them was Ezekiel the prophet. In 586 BC, he burned Jerusalem and took more captives. And then for 13 years, 585 to 573, 13 years, his armies besieged Tyre. In 582 BC, he invaded and plundered Moab, Ammon, Edom, Lebanon. And in 581 BC, he again took captives from Judah. In 572, Nebuchadnezzar invaded and plundered Egypt. And the record tells us that he died in 561 BC. We know that Daniel exerted a powerful influence over Nebuchadnezzar. Three times he called upon the God of Daniel. And we read that in Daniel 2:47, Daniel 3:29 and Daniel 4:34. Now, what about this book of Daniel? Let's take it now and look in Daniel chapter 1 and verse 1. Now, one of the blessings, I guess you could say, of the way that Daniel has written, and we find this in other writings that were written by different prophets and also in the books of history, one of the blessings we have is their method of putting it in time. It says in chapter 1, verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. You see, what this is doing for us here is putting this book in a historical setting, in a period of time that we can clarify from archaeology and from contemporary and other writers. Jesus himself confirmed its genuineness, as I read from Matthew chapter 4 verse 15 in talking about Jesus' comments on Daniel the prophet in my opening statements tonight. It was accepted by the Jews and early Christians. Porphyry, an infidel of the 3rd century AD, propounded a theory that the book was forged during the period of the Maccabean Revolt in 168 to 164 BC. However, the traditional view that the book is a true historical document dating from the days of Daniel himself persisted unanimously among the Christian and Jewish scholars until the rise of modern criticism. Now the critics, in the name of modern scholarship, have revived this theory, and some have tried putting it down as a fact that the book was written by an unknown author who lived 400 years after the days of Daniel. That he assumed Daniel's name, because of course we read in Daniel chapter 7 verse 1 and various other places that it was actually Daniel who wrote the book. And it suggested that this unknown author palmed it off in his own generation as his own spurious work, as being a genuine work of a hero long dead. Of course, if the book is not what it professes to be, how can we think that God would be a party to this deception? For writers to put forth their own ideas in the names of heroes who lived long away is not even common decency and honesty. I guess that the real crux of the attempt to discredit the book of Daniel is the unwillingness of intellectual pride to accept the marvellous miracles and the amazing prophecies that are recorded in the book. And of course, as we will find as we study the prophecies themselves, and the way that the timelines fit in, the 70 weeks, for example, that is found in Daniel chapter 9, the time prophecies that are found in Daniel chapter 7, when we're talking about the beasts, and Daniel chapter 8, when we talk about the ram and the he-goat, you will find that these confirm without a shadow of a doubt, at least in my mind, the authenticity of this book. From chapter 2, verse 4, right through to chapter 7, verse 28, the language of the book is Aramaic or Chaldee. This is the language that Jesus himself spoke. It was the commercial and diplomatic language of the time. The rest of the book is in Hebrew. Of course, this is what you might expect, seeing it was written for Jews living among the Babylonians and it contains copies of the official Babylonian documents in the original Babylonian language. Now let us spend some time looking specifically at this book of Daniel. We'll take a little peek at the basic themes of each of the different chapters, firstly, and then we'll open the book up and focus in on what I believe to be the key verse in the Bible, in the book of Daniel. Chapter 1 introduces Daniel himself. It tells us where he came from and why he was where he was. Chapter 2 discusses a great dream image that Nebuchadnezzar has, and Daniel's involvement in the explanation to Nebuchadnezzar of what this image means, what it's all about. And of course, we learn some very interesting things about the panorama of the history of the world from this chapter. We also learn that Nebuchadnezzar's not content for his kingdom to be just the head of the image. And in fact, chapter 3 begins with the story of Nebuchadnezzar making his own image, but all in gold. It tells the story, a fiery story of a fiery furnace, with the forced worship of this real image. And the furnace for those who disobeyed the worship edict. In 1854, while excavating the ruins of Babylon, the archaeologist Oppert uncovered a pedestal to a colossal statue, which may well have been the remains of Nebuchadnezzar's golden image that we read about in Daniel chapter 3 and verse 1. Daniel chapter 4 is a very interesting chapter in the Bible. It's very much an aside, also on its own. In fact, unlike any other portion of Scripture, this chapter, chapter 4, was written by a pagan king, Nebuchadnezzar. It tells the story of Nebuchadnezzar's insanity for a temporary period of time and of his recovery from insanity. Sir Henry Rawlinson discovered a rather interesting inscription. And this is one of Nebuchadnezzar's writings, and there's a little, perhaps euphemistic, comment here which may well refer to Daniel chapter 4, the only chapter in the Bible written by a pagan king. This is what the inscription read. In 4 years, the residents of my kingdom did not delight my heart. In no one of my possessions did I erect any important building in my might. I did not put up buildings in Babylon for myself and the honour of my name. In the worship of Merodach, my god, I did not sing his praise, nor did I provide his altar with sacrifices, nor clean the canals. Daniel chapter 8 tells of Belshazzar's feast and the finger of God writing upon the wall. It was on the night of the fall of Babylon that this occurred. Daniel had been in Babylon 70 years and he was now a very old man. Now, we had a question earlier with regard to Belshazzar. Until 1853, no mention of Belshazzar was found in Babylonian records, and Nabonidus, 555 to 538 BC, was known to have been the last king of Babylon. Of course, to the critics, this was one of the evidences that the Book of Daniel was not historical. But in 1853, an inscription was found in a cornerstone of a temple built by Nabonidus in Ur to a god. And this read, "May I, Nabonidus, king of Babylon, not sin against thee, and may reverence thee for thee, dwell in the heart of Belshazzar, my firstborn, my favourite son." Of course, we've found other inscriptions since then, and we've learned a lot more about this chap, Nabonidus. You see, much of the time he was in retirement outside the city of Babylon, and that Belshazzar was in control of the army and the government. He was co-regent with his father, and that it was he who surrendered to Cyrus. In the 16th and 29th verses of Daniel chapter 5, we have it mentioned that Daniel was the third ruler of the kingdom. Well, this maybe is the explanation that Nabonidus was the first ruler, that his son, favorite son, Belshazzar, was the second ruler, and Daniel could be regarded in great honor as the third ruler of the kingdom. Now, in Daniel chapter 5, verse 3, it says that Belshazzar's father was in fact Nebuchadnezzar. But let us remember that sometimes father is used as a generic term. We talk of church fathers. We have Jesus himself referring to his father Abraham. Was his literal father called Abraham? No, but his ancestor was Abraham. In the same way that Belshazzar says in verse 2 that his father Nebuchadnezzar took the golden vessels from the temple, and of course we can read that for ourselves in chapter 1 verse 2. Chapter 5 verse 2 tells us that he took these vessels from the temple, and that they had a great feast with these vessels, and they had been taken by his father Nebuchadnezzar. Well, if we remember that father there is just talking about ancestor, and that the father of Belshazzar was Nabonidus, or Nabonidus as some choose to pronounce it. It may help us get an understanding of how the Bible fits in with archaeology. Daniel 6 tells us of the lion's den. You know, there's some wonderful miracles recorded in this book. For those of us who find it difficult sometimes to believe these things, let's remember that for 1,000 years, God had been nurturing the Hebrew nation for the purpose that through his nation, he would establish the idea that God is God. And of course, remember that these were people worshipping idols. They had lost the idea of who God was. You see, God's nation had been destroyed by a nation that worshipped idols. So there was sort of, I suppose you could call it evidence, you see, that the God of the idols was more powerful than the God of the Hebrews. It was a crisis in God's struggle with idolatry. If ever there was a time when God had needed to do something to show who is God, it was during this Babylonian captivity. That is, I believe, why they have these miracles recorded at this time. In fact, it'd be strange, I guess, if nothing unusual had happened at all. Something would have been lacking in the Bible story if these stupendous miracles had not been wrought. Hard as it seems to believe them, I guess it would be harder to believe the story without them. At least the Jews, who had from the beginning been always falling into idolatry, were now at last, in the Babylonian captivity, convinced that their own God was the true God. And they've never since relapsed into idolatry. No doubt these miracles had something to do with them. We know from chapter 3, verse 29, that they had an influence on Nebuchadnezzar. And chapter 6, verse 26, that they certainly had an influence on Darius. Chapter 7 is a continuation of the prophecy that we talked about in chapter 2, but this chapter 7 was uttered 70 years later. And we have four beasts, a lion, a bear, a leopard, and a nondescript, a terrible beast. And also in this chapter are introduced some time prophecies. Things which so clearly give authenticity to God's handiwork in Daniel's writing and the miraculous preservation of this great book. Chapter 8 continues the prophecy with illustrations of a ram and a he-goat. Chapter 9 introduces the 70-week prophecy. And chapters 10 to 12 contain a vision given 2 years after the Jews had returned to Palestine, in 534 BC. It appears that God had lifted the veil and showed Daniel the angels of the nations, chapter 10, the kings of the north and the kings of the south in chapter 11, and the time of the end in chapter 12. Daniel was absolutely unswerving in his religious convictions, and yet so loyal to an idolatrous king that he was trusted with the affairs of the empire. Which brings me to what I believe is a key verse in the book of Daniel. Turn with me to Daniel chapter 1. And I'm reading from verse 8. And I'm only going to read the first few words of that verse. You see, the earlier verses tell us that Daniel was taken into captivity along with many others, including some friends whose names were mentioned, and they were given names that were inappropriate to their Hebrew names. Daniel, for example, was Belteshazzar, keeper of the hidden secrets of the god of Bel, in place of the name Daniel, which means God is my judge. Hananiah and Shadrach had names that were changed. Hananiah's name was the Lord is gracious unto me. And Shadrach was the inspiration of the sun. And of course their names were changed to names representing the different gods of the time. However, despite this, and despite the fact that they were provided with things, food that they shouldn't eat and wine that they shouldn't drink, it says in verse 8 that Daniel purposed in his heart. And I think that this is the key to the writings of the prophet Daniel. The fact that we have a man who is prepared to purpose in his heart to do what his God wants him to do. And we find in the very next verse that God does exactly that. And it said that God brought Daniel into favor and love with the people around him. And so the key, I believe, to understanding this book of prophecy is not just to compare it with other parts of the Bible, not just to compare it with history, not just to compare it with our own understandings of what God is like, but to remember that this is a book about a man who purposed in his heart to follow the Lord's will right through to the end. And as we study the book of Daniel, as we search its pages, let us purpose in our heart to follow the God of Daniel right through to the end.